Well, I'm tired, I'm sweaty, and I smell like sawdust.
Then it must be time to record MyMac.com podcast number 119.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com podcast.
And the reason I smell like sawdust is I've been working in the house all day long today. I didn't go into the client's business and make money. I've been spending money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, you got to do that. And when you own a house, you got to keep care of it. And if you plan on selling it anytime soon, you got to do upgrades to it.
Well, besides Tim and myself, we have our other co-host, Guy Searle, here.
Hi, Guy.
Hello.
And we're joined by a special guest this week, the longest-running person at MyMac.com that's been associated with the site, which means he's particularly insane, Russ Walkowicz. Hi, Russ.
Good evening, gentlemen.
You know, the first thing posted from Russ Walkowicz was in November of 1995, and it was called System Setup. That was a long time ago, Russ.
Long? I'm sorry, it's ancient.
in internet days, that would be like 30 years ago, I think.
That was pre-floppy.
How did you get involved with MyMac.com? It wasn't even MyMac.com then. I mean, it was just MyMac magazine.
I think I was one of the first 250,000 users on AOL and doing a search for Mac items. I came across this strange writing by this guy named Robertson, Tim.
But that should have been your first clue right there.
That's right.
And I started to read what he was writing, which was very different from what I was seeing elsewhere with, like, Mac User or Mac World. This wasn't designed for the people with a $15,000 budget to go out and buy the very best. This was designed for the everyday user.
People that were broke.
Well, I don't want to say that.
Well, it was probably that and the promise to save you a spot on the mothership when they came to get him. So
yeah.
I am from the mothership.
Yes.
Oh.
it was... we've had so many... I mean, Russ has seen everybody...
I've edited
come
everybody.
And go at this point. And I don't think there's anybody else. I think you were around before our ex-webmaster, Adam Carnebogi, was here.
Yes.
You were, yeah, because he didn't start till 96.
Yep.
You were here before Pete Miner?
Yep.
Yeah, see. When did you become the editor of MyMac magazine? I know you eventually became that, and I'll forever be grateful because... without your help, we wouldn't have got to the next level that we did. But I don't remember when you actually became editor.
Do you know, I think somewhere in my files, I actually still have the email that you sent me asking if I wanted to have a job with you, unpaid, of course.
Hey, you want to do work and not get paid?
I seem to do a lot of that.
Yeah, join the club. it's hard to imagine, Russ, especially for Guy and Chad, who are relatively newbies at MyMac.com, how it was run and how we produced a monthly digital magazine that was every issue was over 100 issues or 100 pages.
Yes.
But many times it was over 200 pages. And we're not talking about, you know, huge typefaces and a ton of graphics. This was text. This was all written material that was 200 pages a month sometimes. And it was every month.
Well, plus the centerfold.
Well, yeah, of course. Do you want to kind of run down a little bit for the history buffs on how we actually put this thing together, what the kind of the workflow was?
Usually what wound up happening at the very beginning was everyone would email me their article. I would edit it, re-edit it, try and put it all together. We were using DocMaker.
Yeah, precursor to Adobe PDF.
and put it into a package, send it to Tim. Tim would review it, correct anything I missed,
which wasn't much.
Then he'd send it back to me, and I'd look at it again. So we had black type, yellow type, green type, red type of all the different corrections.
All right, so we could track, you know, who had made a correction. Because sometimes it was like, well, how do we abbreviate megabyte? Is it capital M, capital B? Is it smaller MB? Is there a space between them? Because this is all so relatively new to everybody mm-hmm. that there's always a lot of questions. So if Russ would change one little word, I would have no idea by looking at it because it was just so much content. So many words, there's no way you could. So we had to change the coloring mm-hmm. so I could go, oh, there's an edit from Russ. And eventually, though, we brought in a second copy editor.
Jim.
Yeah. And honestly, I kind of lost touch with Jim over the years. He initially, I think, wanted to write for us.
Yes.
And I don't know how he became.
That's
I think he volunteered.
The way it starts.
Yeah. I think he volunteered to help us put the issue together
right.
as far as editing. So it would go from you to me. No, it would go from you to Jim, and then back to you, and then to me.
And then back to
me. And then back to you. And then back to me to finish it and put it to bed. That's crazy.
And this was every
single month. We never missed a month, did we, Russ?
No. And it took about 3.5 weeks to put one issue together.
Yeah, so by the time we actually released that issue, we were already working on the next issue. And quite honestly, it wasn't so much different than what they do in the print world today, except when we put ours to bed, it was live right then. In the print mm-hmm. world, when they put it to bed, it goes to the printer, and it's still weeks away from actually hitting the newsstand, if not a month. So we would our content was always very fresh. And you know,
what I remember, because I think I met you, what,
96, 97, yeah. No, it was after I was separated.
Yeah, it was after you were separated.
So that would have been probably, 97.
See, and I remember you guys used to have to distribute that thing electronically over your 14.4 baud modem.
Oh, please don't remind me about that.
Yeah. Okay, starting the download. See you tomorrow.
Speaking of downloading... for the longest time, the conversation with Russ would begin, up until like just a couple years ago, would begin with, so is there any word about high-speed internet access in your area, Russ? And then the answer was always the same, which was?
No.
No. you live in a large area that there's no reason that it should have. When did you finally get high-speed internet access? Like 2005?
2004, the summer of 2004.
Yeah, and I remember it was a pretty milestone event because you were so psyched about that.
Trust me, the sound of a modem was destroying my hearing. And even when I turned it off, I could still hear it, just mentally.
And that was through Comcast?
No, I had different ISPs up until I got Comcast. When they finally...
No, that's what I meant. The high speed was Comcast, though.
Yes.
So the reason we kind of brought you on the show, other than talk about a little bit about history and that sort of thing, was... And Russ is hopefully going to stick with us through our segment here. Mm-hmm. Is you've got a article posted called Verizon... Is it Fios?
Fios.
Fios.
What does that stand for?
Hmm.
Who are you asking?
The person that actually has the service.
You know, that was one of the questions I never asked. I didn't care what it stood for.
Absolutely nothing.
So this is a fiber optic system rather than a cable modem.
Yes.
So you've got this article posted. Tell us a little bit about it. What did it take to get it installed, and what's the result so far?
When... About a year ago, contractors started showing up in the neighborhood with their entrenching tools and just started digging up everybody's yard. No warning. So the usual thing was, hi, you mind telling me what you're doing on my lawn? We're installing fiber. We're going to be running it for Verizon. And then it became, what are they doing? They're going to be doing the internet. They're going to be doing new fiber TV and also phone lines. That happened last year in the spring. Didn't hear anything at all from Verizon until late fall. I was out of the area for a while. By the time I got back at the end of December.
You were in prison, weren't you?
Yes. Huh. Sent up the river. They finally caught up for me for all of that editing.
I heard the police cars go by. I figured that was you.
That was me.
They're coming to get Russ. Okay, go on.
As long as they're after him and not me.
So what wound up happening was I started doing a lot of research. Number one, there had been a lot of articles online about incompatibility of Fios with Macs, that there were issues. The speed wasn't the same. The capabilities weren't the same. People were having major problems. And just about with everything else that you deal with when you're a Mac user, they don't understand Macs at all.
Yeah, that's pretty common.
Yeah.
So what I wound up doing was a lot of research online. I got to become very friendly with the people at Verizon because I'd call them every now and then and ask them a whole other series of questions, which then precipitated a lot more research. And finally, one of the other neighbors across the street from me went ahead and had the internet access put in. And I checked with him, and he just began to rave. He also had Comcast.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you just will not believe how fast it is. So I finally made the determination, enough's enough, particularly when I had a problem on a Sunday with Comcast. The no access to the internet, but the TV was fine. Picture was great.
Yeah, I had that. Yep.
That's weird.
No, it's not. It happens to me all the time.
So,
And I have Comcast.
Same here.
And
they always ask the same question. Have you reset your modem? Have you turned your modem on and off and recycled it? Have you unplugged your router?
Yes.
Is the cable working on the lower channels really well?
Is the moon in the seventh house?
Yes. Is Venus aligned with Mars? So what wound up happening was I'm online with the tech, and he goes, okay, we're going to test your system. He says, I'm going to send a test pulse. He then proceeds to tell me that there's something wrong with your modem. He says, can you see this on the front? And I said, no. He goes, well, you should. I said, why should I?
Well, that narrows it down.
Oh, of course. And he goes, well, you have our modem and router, right? I said, no. Oh, that explains it. Your equipment's bad. You're going to need to run out and buy some new stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think so.
And basically what wound up happening was I thanked him very much for his help. I had to run out to the store, and as I'm leaving the area, there's a Comcast truck just outside of the development here. So I pulled over, guy's up in the bucket, and I said, you know, mind if I ask you a question? No. I said, are you working on a problem with internet access? Yeah, none of the modems work in this area.
Wah, wah.
Yeah, they got good communications in that area, don't they?
Well,
Comcast.
See, that's it exactly. The right hand, left hand didn't know what's going on. They're telling me to run out and buy some new equipment. And when I told the tech that, who's up in the bucket, he goes, why in God's name did they tell you that?
Because that's all he knows how to say.
Yeah, because there's a 3x5 card that he's reading these, or he or she is reading these answers from.
Written in crayon.
Yeah.
And then they go to the next set, which is when customer becomes irate, agree with them totally. Yes, we understand.
Yep, but that's exactly right.
Oh, I have the meaning for FiOS here. I actually have two meanings for it. Apparently, according to the Verizon FiOS Wikipedia entry, it's the Irish word for knowledge. But in a mailing to New Jersey customers, Verizon stated it stood for Fiber, F-I, Optic Service. Mystery solved.
I would probably say that the,
like the
Verizon
better.
I do too.
It's what people that don't know any better name their dogs.
No, that's Fido.
I can totally relate to the Comcast story, though. It, exactly the same type of thing has happened to me over and over. I have had cable now since, what, 99?
Mm-hmm.
No, 98. I've had cable modem since 1998, high-speed internet access, almost 10 years. And it was a godsend at first, but I don't even remember what company it was back then. But that company got sold to another company that got sold to another company that eventually became Comcast.
It was AT&T originally.
Well, not originally. No, it wasn't. No, it was another company. And then it merged with another company, and then AT&T took over, and then Comcast took over from them. So Comcast is the fourth company. And it was only until last year I was still using the same RCA cable modem. And I believe I talked about that on the show, that, you know, it finally stopped working. I couldn't figure out what was going on because this cable modem was rock solid up to this point. And they said, oh, yeah, we stopped supporting that cable modem like a year and a half ago. I'm like, oh, that's great. I'm so pleased that you guys send out notices to your clients and your customers that, you know, their equipment is obsolete that they've been using since, you know, 98 and that you're going to come out and give me a new one. They did, and it still drops the connection. Well, probably every three or four days, I have to reset that cable modem. I have to unplug it, wait for 10 seconds, plug it back in. And if that doesn't work, I call them up and I have them pulse my system, and then that resets it, and then it works. But it's just a big, huge pain in the ass. And then if there really is a problem, they really do need to come out and fix it. It's always a week before they could come out. We can come out a week from Saturday, if you like. We can be there at 10 to 4. Can you be home between 10 and 4?
And you must be home.
Yeah, you must be home, exactly.
And they always give you that same look if they have to come in the house and look at your system. Oh, it's a Mac. I don't know anything.
I don't let them touch my computer when they come in. I'm like, step away from the keyboard.
I don't let them come
driving.
In.
So you got fed up. Your neighbor was lusting and finally went ahead and got the Verizon fiber. You got fed up with Comcast and decided to do the same, I take it.
Yes. But I also went for Verizon's TV package.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How is it? Both.
Superb. Excellent.
Really?
I would highly recommend it.
Well, because I had basic Comcast, because I had installed the DirecTV dish myself.
Right.
Yeah.
I had DirecTV. I had Comcast basic to get the local channels because DirecTV didn't offer it. And with the basic cable, I paid an additional $42 for internet access. With Verizon, it's $49. And I went from 5 Mbps to 15.
Wow. For $7. So 5 megabits per second to 15 megabits per second. So you basically tripled your speed.
Yes.
Wow. And basically for what?
$7
more a month? Seven more, yeah. Wow. But what really impresses me is your upload speed.
Yeah.
Now, being a Comcast subscriber myself, I know how slow my upload speeds are. And most people don't have to upload. Most people are downloading stuff. That's what they're worried about. But as the owner of MyMac.com, I am constantly putting these MP3s up on our server, which means I have to upload them.
Mm-hmm.
Upload takes forever. Even if our files are, say, 12 megabytes, that's a half hour, usually. Yeah. And that's retarded. There's no absolutely no reason it should be that slow. And that's a self-imposed, on Comcast's part, limitation. Mm-hmm. They purposely do that. So you can't host your own web server on their network and all that kind of crap. But, you know, it just, it drives me crazy. And, you know, you look at their advertising and they say, up to this speed, right? Mm-hmm. I never even come close to those speeds. Never.
Now, Fios, Verizon will tell you the same thing. That's part and parcel. You can't host your own web server or anything like that.
And I understand that, but, you know, that doesn't mean they should retard my upload speeds, because there's physically no reason that they have to. There's no reason. They just do it, I think, just to irritate me.
Jim Robert, it was part of the executive package. Irritate.
Yeah, there's
Jim
a whole
Robert.
Boardroom full of them saying, "Oh, this is really going to piss Robertson off."
I think they put it like on a spinning wheel, and they just and it lands on something. Okay, we're increasing the rates by 12%. That'll really piss him off.
And lowering the bandwidth.
But
I'll tell you what, I'm really impressed, because what I wound up doing was I ditched Comcast, I ditched DirecTV, because Verizon offers DirecTV.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Through the fiber?
Through the fiber.
Hmm.
So my television picture is of the same high quality as DirecTV, but when a storm comes, or there's heavy rain,
yeah,
or
yeah,
it
you
snows.
Don't have to worry about it. Yeah. So Verizon's television offering technically isn't their own offering. They're just kind of using DirecTV.
Yes.
Does that include your local channels too?
It includes both DC and Baltimore, and the reception is absolutely great.
Wow. Now, I don't know if you've got an HD set. I don't think so, but do they offer a high definition signal as well?
Yes.
Sweet.
And nice. I asked that question because I don't have HD TV. I said, I did go for the DVR.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, now in 2 years, quote, you have to switch to HD.
No.
I'm going along the aspect that that's what everybody is being told. It's
no, what they're saying is that all terrestrial signals have to be digital. It doesn't have to be high definition, but it does have to be digital.
Well, see, here in the DC area, they're saying HD, and they're pushing the HD TV sets like you wouldn't believe.
Well, they're doing that everywhere, though. Yeah.
So one of the first questions...
You almost can't buy a TV now that's not an HD set.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the first questions I asked them was, am I going to need to upgrade my equipment in the future? And they said, no. When you go HD TV, you just let us know, and we take care of it from here. There's nothing.
Sweet.
There's no change, nothing. So none of the equipment needs to get changed out.
You'll like HD. I mean, it's... If I have a choice to watch the same program, say, CBS, mm-hmm. on standard definition or high definition, there's no choice.
Right.
I swap over to high definition because the picture quality is just unreal. You know, it is the next big step in viewing.
Well, and frankly, for video games, it's just amazing. With the Xbox 360, it's just...
And the PS3. It really is the future. Most of the new DVD players are coming out will actually upgrade or upscale your regular standard DVDs to high definition, 1080i. It just looks fantastic. So, but you know, there's a huge infrastructure in everyone's homes with televisions. The average family owns more than one television. And even though the prices of HDTVs are coming down, I don't know too many families who can go out and drop $1,500 for
right.
a big
for two
and a small
32-inch HD.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've got an HDTV, but like I've said on the podcast in the past, it's not a flat screen HDTV. It's also not a rear projection. It is mm-hmm. a CRT, big ass, almost 200-pound television that, quite honestly, it gets a better picture than most of the flat screens that are still out there. But I don't have HDMI or DVI inputs on the television, mm-hmm. which drive me crazy.
Yeah, I haven't gotten an HDTV yet.
Yeah, it will. And Chad hasn't either. He talked about that just last week.
Yep.
Once you go HDVD, you don't go back. I've heard that somewhere before. Speaking of TVs, let's get a little bit into a little bit something different here. I'm saying a little bit because I'm kind of jumping around on the screen over here. Rune Anderson, longtime listener of the podcast. Mm-hmm. He's been listening for a long time. I remember getting emails from Rune back in 2005.
I've been doing this podcast for a long time.
Did I tell you? He has some suggestions on stuff we could talk about on the show.
Yeah.
So, Chad will... Can you read it from there, Chad?
Sure. One of the things he suggests, he talks about the Apple TV delays. He said, Apple's announced a delay of shipping the Apple TVs to late March, and no reason was given. But I have a theory about why this has happened. A, the draft N may be a standard for 802.11n in March. The 802.11n will probably be decided in March and released, and to release Apple TV at the same time would be a smart idea for Apple. And I also think this is what Steve Jobs is thinking as well, since Apple always releases products before anyone else, and when they release a product, it usually works.
I don't know about that.
I would probably tend to disagree with that, only in that Apple's already had 802.11n chips in all the new Macs for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it was the pre-standard, and I don't see that that would have been a problem. It may have been, some people are speculating that it's FCC approval, that they hadn't got full approval. And remember, this is a wireless device, so they do need FCC approval to put it on the market. I don't really see this as a problem anyways, to be honest. If you were going to buy an Apple TV, and I'll be honest, I want one, I probably will get one soon, I would rather, when it come out, that it just works and that it's not buggy. So if it's going to take Apple even a month or so later to release it, that's fine. Just work out those bugs before I plop down my hard-earned cash and I get a piece of crap. Yeah, that's at least my opinion. Mm-hmm. Next, he goes into Boot Camp versus Parallels.
All right, and Rune writes, Parallels has released the final version of Parallels Desktop for Mac. The new feature is extremely good, and you can now run Windows applications more easily and better than previous beta releases. I think that Parallels finally has a product that would increase Mac sales and be a nice alternative to Boot Camp.
What do you guys think? Parallels
versus Boot Camp.
I would have to say that if I was going to have my druthers, I would go with Parallels, simply because I just don't want to have to keep booting and rebooting the machine.
What about playing games on your Mac?
I'll take the hit. I'll take the hit on having a little less performance for the convenience factor.
Yeah, but you know, if you just reboot into... Here's one aspect you're maybe not thinking about, not just you, Guy, but as well as Rune. With the new Parallels, you can actually boot up Vista or XP from a Boot Camp partition drive. In other words, if you download Boot Camp, and it's going to come free with 10.5, by the way.
Right.
And there's some speculation that Apple may actually charge for Boot Camp for 10.4 users once 10.5 comes out. I don't think they will, but that's out there.
No.
And remember, Boot Camp is still technically a beta product.
Mm-hmm.
You can literally install Vista on your Mac
using Vista Boot. Only.
Well,
that's another story.
There's no technical limitations. Let's just put it that way. You would just be in violation of the terms of agreement. Speaking of which, I've mentioned that I was still waiting for Microsoft to send me Vista.
Mm-hmm.
Vista Ultimate came in the mail today.
Oh, dynamite. Nice.
Woohoo!
It's gone just a to disc. The dark side.
It's just a disc and a serial number. It didn't have, they didn't give me a box or anything with it. I was like, yeah, thanks. It's just a Mac guy.
Because it's so easy, you don't need a manual.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So you can install Vista via Boot Camp. And then after you've done that, you can also install Parallels, and it will boot that volume.
Mm.
So you don't have to have two different installs. So you can literally have the best of both worlds. You can run applications anytime you need to in Parallels, but if you do want to play a game, reboot in Boot Camp, and you're off and running on a Vista machine or XP machine at native speeds. So thus, any game that you can play on the PC, providing that it's not a super graphic-heavy game, You could do it. It's no problem. So there's your solution, guy. You can have it both ways.
Yeah, but first I would actually have to want Windows. Now, I use Windows all day at work, and you know, typically when I hit that little log off button, it makes this wah 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 wah, you know, it's kind of log off sound.
Yeah.
And that sound right there tells me I'm going home, baby. So I don't want to hear that sound when I get here to the house.
Hmm.
There's not really, I don't really have, I mean, I got two kids. I don't have that much time for games. Wish I did.
I've got three kids and I've got time.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, I've been playing a game that's so addictive. Chad sat and watched me play and had a good time for a couple hours on Sunday.
Yeah, they could have dropped the tail end off that name, too, and they probably had it correct.
Yeah. We're talking about Crackdown for anybody who cares. Let's go back to Rune's email. He asks, what about macOS 10.5 and iLife 07?
Mm. And Rune writes, the version of Mac OS 10 is going to be released perhaps in June, but where is the iLife 07? I think that 10.5 would be released in March or more likely April. This would perhaps be a special event with the release of iLife 07. And finally, the new Mac Pro quad core and perhaps the famous and one more thing from Steve Jobs.
What do you think, Russ? When do you think 10.5 is coming?
Well, after I need it, that's for sure.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Probably, I'm going to go with April.
April?
Yep.
So next month?
Yep.
Guy?
I think it's not going to be until June. I think they're going to hold their original schedule, and that chances are iLife and iWork will come out after Leopard.
Yeah, I'd agree with the end of that. What do you think, mm-hmm. Chad?
I'm thinking probably June myself.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say we're not going to see it until almost the very end of July.
You think it'll be delayed that much?
Yeah, there's some really buggy stuff going on with it that hasn't really been worked out. It's not as stable as it really needs to be this late in the development cycle.
Mm.
And once again, I think it's going to be an Apple TV scenario in that Apple's just simply going to delay it and release a product that works
rather than
sticking with an arbitrary deadline that we have to ship by. It's definitely not going to be March like Rune suggests.
Mm-hmm.
This is March right now. There's no way it's coming out.
Oh, he said more likely in April, actually.
Yeah, and it's not March. Going to be released in April either. So I think we're probably going to see mid to late summer release. And some people are going to be mad about that. But let's be honest. Would you rather have it ship and stable or ship and literally waiting around for this update to fix a variety of bugs?
I'm quite happy with 10.4 at this time. So
Same here.
It takes them a little bit more time to get it out right, no big deal.
Yeah, and I don't think we will see iLife 07 until after 10.5 is released.
Yeah.
And those days when Steve would stand on stage and announce something to say, and it's for sale right now.
He still does that. I mean,
he didn't at the last one.
Well, no.
Here's all this great stuff, but you can't buy it.
You can't buy it. What were you going to say, Russ?
I don't know. I forgot.
Welcome to my world.
Let me run to Rune's last prediction. He said, I also suggested the release of iLife 07 and 10.5 would be released in coordination with a new iPod, similar to the iPhone, but without the phone, and with 802.11n, and possibly a new iTunes.
What is that noise? Someone's doing something. Stop it.
It's not me.
Not me.
Okay. So he thinks that it's going to be released right around the same time then as a new iPod?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well, for his predictions, that would put it probably in April for a new iPod.
Apple definitely needs to come out with a new full-size iPod.
I don't think we'll see it until after everything else comes out.
Yeah, I think because... I would agree with you. I just don't see a new iPod coming out until after 10.5 ships.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to throw something out
there. There's too much stuff going on right now. You've got, 10.5 is coming out. iLife, iWork, Apple TV. You've got the new 802.11m Apple Extreme. You know, I mean, they've got, and also look at it this way. iPod sales are still going up.
Yeah.
Even without even without a new model, they're still going up.
Are we going to see a new iPod before the iPhone or after the iPhone?
After.
After. I think that Apple doesn't want to try to cannibalize any sales for the potential sales for the iPhone. I think that they want to get that out on the market. I think they want it on the market for at least a month or two.
Mm-hmm.
I think they want people to start seeing it around town, and they think, wow, that's cool.
So you're thinking the next iPod's going to be like around WWDC?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, August, September.
Yep, that's exactly what I think, too. Because let's be honest, if you see somebody with an iPhone, how are you going to feel with your old iPod next to it? It's going to look like a clunky brick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because that iPhone is so sexy. It really is. Or Zune.
Well, you know, obviously for you, if you were to see it, then you'd be looking at your iPod thinking, well, maybe the next Mac mod will be turning this into a really cool cigarette case. So.
With a built-in lighter.
You know, I've got a Newton. I thought about maybe turning a Newton into an iPod. I thought that might be kind of neat.
Oh, that would be cool.
But then I thought,
look at it this way.
You have to get another screen for it.
You could just carry it on your shoulder like a boombox.
Yeah, there you go.
This is my organizer.
What was your first Macintosh, Russ?
A Performer, let me think, 405?
Oh, my God. That was like the LC2 clone, wasn't it? Or the LC, like yeah. the LC2?
I had a Performer 410.
I won't talk to about the Commodore 128 I started with.
You know, we all had to start somewhere. It's funny when you look back and think about how slow those old computers were. But when you think about that, Russ, what we're doing today, MyMac.com, is a direct result of the work we were doing on that Performa 405 and Performa 410, you know, back in 95.
Oh, yes.
So mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people like to kind of snicker and put their nose up a little bit to those old machines, how mm-hmm. slow they were, and, oh, that's so quaint. Well, you know what? We got a lot of work done on those old machines.
It just
took a lot of work.
Do you know I still have them?
Oh, I do, too. Yep. It's hard getting rid of your old machines, isn't it?
That's what the wife keeps saying.
I've never had that problem.
Yeah.
I had a Plus that I ended up giving to my kids' school, which was my first machine from back in 87. And I've had I had a couple of the Mac clones and a few other machines and got rid of them all. No problem at all.
Finally, before we wrap this segment up, I want to do a little bit of a reminder. Next week, when you guys listen to this show, it will be a special podcast that Chad and I recorded live at the Apple Store in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to be there on March 10th. From 2 to 3:30 p.m. I'm really, really looking forward to it. They actually have a display up there of some flyers
yep.
at the Apple Store announcing that we're going to be at the event.
It's on Rick the site, Stringer, too.
Yeah. Well, it's on their calendar, yes.
Yeah.
I don't think our PDF is there. We're going to have a lot of stuff to give away. It's going to be mm-hmm. a lot of fun. We're going to have what's called an Apple quiz. Chad and I are going to ask questions of the audience. If you get the answer right, you're going to win something cool. This is the entire list of everything that we're giving away. And I know this is probably not the most exciting thing to hear as a podcast mm-hmm. listener right now, but these are companies that are giving us something to give away for free. And I really do want to thank them publicly and let people know the product and the company that we're giving away stuff. So from the Microsoft Corporation, I think everybody's heard of them. They're this little developer up in Redmond.
Mm-hmm.
We've got two copies of Microsoft Office 2004.
Yeah, people use those.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
We've got also from Microsoft a wireless laser desktop keyboard and mouse. We've got two of those. Go ahead.
We've got one copy of Roxio Toast from Roxio.
I need
two copies of Zingtone 5. And two copies of Popcorn 2, all from Roxio.
And my headphones just came unplugged. And
you can't hear anything.
So did Chad's. We can't hear anything right now. Ah, the show comes to a screeching halt. From Wiley Publishing, We've got four books. That's right, four books. We've got MacBook for Dummies. We've got iMac for Dummies. We've got iPod and iTunes for Dummies. And the GarageBand book.
From Other World Computing, we've got Mercury On The Go, bus-powered portable storage solution, which is an 80-gigabyte, 7,200 RPM hard drive.
Nice.
They are. Other World Computing also sent the Mercury Elite AL Pro quad interface storage solution. That's really cool.
From Newer Technologies, we've got a 250-gig mini stack V2 external storage.
Now, solution. Russ, didn't you do the review of the version 2 of the mini stack? Is that a pretty nice unit?
Very, very nice.
Now, that looks just like the Mac Mini, correct?
It exactly, and you can stack them one on top of the other, and you're talking something smaller than half a loaf of bread.
Now, is that one drive or awesome. Two drives?
What?
It's got one drive in it.
Okay. I think three you can and a half inch. Without one as well.
Well, this one that we're giving away comes with a 250 gigabyte internal hard drive in it. So, yeah, absolutely. And remember, you got to remember when 10.5 comes out, you're going to need another hard drive so you can start backing up your machine.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Time Machine's going to do it automatically for you. So if you've got a Mac Mini, this is exactly what you're going to want. Newer Technology also gave us two of the Traffic Jam's wireless FM transmitter. They gave us a white one and a black one.
And we also have the Griffin Technologies iKaraoke, two of those.
Two of the iTalk Pro, which I really, really dig the iTalk. That's awesome. It basically turns your iPod into a big microphone.
And we could use that in January at Mac at World Expo.
Oh, God, that would have been great. And Griffin also sent us
two of the iTrip Autos.
So that's everything that we've got to give away at the store.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a running contest for the home listener. How do they enter the home contest chat?
They send us an email with their name, address, and phone number to contest@mymac.com.
And I just simply throw them in a folder. I will randomly pick the winners before we actually go up to the event, so I don't have to be screwing around and decide who. I'll already know who, and we'll announce it on the show at the Apple Store, the home people. Who are going to get stuff. Rune entered the contest, I noticed.
Oh, cool.
Are they going to send it directly to the winners, or are you going to have to ship that?
Yes. This is not a product that I have in my possession. It's going to go directly from the company, from the sponsor, directly to the winner. So that's a lot of stuff we're giving away. If you want to see it, head up to mymac.com. Under the features, look for Podcast Live at the Apple Store, and you will see pictures of all the cool swag we're giving away. Gotta love the swag.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have some t-shirts, too, from MacSales.com. When we say Other World Computing, go to MacSales.com. So that's our segment this week. And really appreciate Guy and Russ joining us. Chad, as always, it's been my pleasure. And we didn't have David Cohen, but let's jump right to his segment now.
Hello, my name is David Cohen and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration 25. Today I'm going to spend some time talking about Office 2007 and the new user interface that's been introduced with this product. The new interface is called the Ribbon. And basically what it does is it dispenses with the menu system that's been with Office ever since it was created back in the early 90s. An ongoing problem with Office as it's become more feature-rich over the years is accessing the new functions in an effective manner. Those menus you see at the top of the screen that have been there since the product was created have just become more and more bloated with features over the years. And increasingly, it's been found that Office users are asking Microsoft for features that are already available in the Office products. They just can't find them effectively. Consequently, with Office 2007, Microsoft's team has taken a deliberate approach to try and resolve this problem. And in my view, it's fairly successful. What they've done is taken the menus away from the product they've replaced the menus with a series of tabs, and each tab brings up a different type of ribbon. Effectively, what they've done is reorganized all the menus so that all the like functions are grouped together. And what happens is, as you click on each tab, you get a changing large toolbar at the top of the screen that illustrates all the various functions that are available in that tab. There's an annotated version that appears by default, and if you click on any one of the individual areas of the ribbon, it expands out to show more functionality. The toolbar works in such a way that the functions being depicted in the buttons are actually clearly previewed, either within the button bar area itself or actually in the document. So, for example, there's a whole section in Word which illustrates the different styles available to the document. If you click on one of these styles while you have some text selected, you will see the selected text will, after a moment, briefly transform to show you the new style. If you then click on that button bar, it will apply that style to the text you've selected. Like all the best user interfaces, describing it makes it sound much more complicated than it actually is to use. I've got to admit, when I first tried Office 2007, it was a real culture shock, because I've had those many years of being ingrained with the menu and the toolbar system. But once you get over that and you start to realise where things are, you realise it's actually a much cleaner and easier way to show the interface to you. And this apparently has been backed up by Microsoft's own research. Since Office 2007 was released, they found that usability reports fed back to them through the product's online systems have been showing that various features that people barely used in the past are now being used much more. A good example of this is watermarking within Word. Watermarking is a technology where you can basically apply a very faint outline image or word to a document. For instance, a lot of people might use it to have the word draft in large capital letters diagonally across a page behind a document text, so anyone picking the document up can be perfectly clear that it's not the final release version. Now, what they've done with the ribbon is it's very, very easy to create these watermarks now. That functionality is all grouped together and is pretty straightforward, whereas in the past you needed to delve very deeply into the menus to get it to be applied to a document. And what Microsoft are reporting is that there's an awful lot more documents out there now that have this watermark applied, purely because users are able to access the functionality via Word 2007. The net result of this is that Microsoft Office 2007 is being hailed as one of the best products Microsoft has released in quite a long while, and that includes the latest version of Windows Microsoft Vista. Regular listeners to Fenestration will be aware that I've talked at some length in the past about the new file formats that Office offers, and obviously there's an issue there with terms of compatibility with the current Macintosh version of Office. But despite these issues, I still feel that Office 2007 is a very strong product. The ribbon interface is not all hype. It's something that I am using myself, and I'm finding it's increasing my productivity on a day-by-day basis. I am thankful, therefore, that I have the opportunity to run this software by being able to run Parallels and run Office 2007 within it. This raises an interesting paradigm shift for a user interface between Mac and Windows, though. When I switched to the Mac, which was about 2.5 years ago now, one of the things I did like about Office 2004 was that I thought that its interface was slightly superior to Office 2003 for Windows. The style palette paradigm that Office 2004 for Macintosh offers to users is really effective in my view. The ability to select a piece of text in Word, say, and to be see via the style palette all the various different aspects of the formatting and arrangement of that text, in my view, is very powerful. And I felt that was one of the advantages of the Mac platform, that the innovative and unrestricted approach to the user interface led to more productive applications than you could find on Windows. So you might think this is all great. The version of Office for Macintosh is due later on this year, probably third quarter is the latest dates we've been given. So you would expect that they will take the opportunity to incorporate this new, revolutionary and very well accepted user interface into their application. Well, unfortunately, no. Now, I'll admit it's early days and we've not seen any betas of Office 2008 for Mac yet, so I'm not going to be too judgmental at this stage, but the early indications from screenshots delivered at Macworld and discussions with the Macintosh business units at Macworld are that they are intending to incorporate certain aspects of the Ribbon interface into their design for Office 2008. Now, what the screenshots show is that they're incorporating the look and feel of the Ribbon into Office 2008, but not the actual functionality. In fact, you have the worst of all worlds, because the File, Edit, View, Insert menu that's been at the top of Office for ages is still there in the Macintosh version, together with a Ribbon that takes a fair amount of real estate space on your desktop. Now, if you've got menus which are complicated and still loaded up with functions, and you've got a Ribbon that's taking desktop real estate away from you, in my view, that's going to be the worst of all worlds. Remember, the whole design ethos behind the Ribbon in Office 2007 for Windows was to try and expose functionality within the product that's been hidden down in the depths of the menus for ages. So if the menu is still there, then that problem is still going to exist with Office 2008. And if they use some other way of exposing that functionality up to the front, then why do they still need the menu? It's only confusing. And of course, what you're going to get is a situation where a user of Office 2007 for Windows, if they want to switch to the Mac and run the Mac version of Office, will have a completely different user interface and interaction experience with Office than they do with the Windows version. And that's definitely a step change from what you've had before. Because while Office 2004 for Mac has various changes and differences, like those style palettes I was talking about a few minutes ago, it actually functionally works very much the same as Office 2003 for Windows, and you can switch between one and the other relatively easily. This is not going to be the case if Office 2008 for Mac and Office 2007 for Windows have a completely different style of user interface. Now, as you might imagine, Microsoft has a party line to explain this difference. I've heard it quoted by Microsoft staff at Macworld, and I also heard it quoted just last week on the Windows Weekly podcast that's available on the Twit network from Leo Laporte. He interviewed two members of the Microsoft team who developed the Ribbon UI for Office 2007, and he asked them, because he's a big Mac user, whether Office 2008 would incorporate the Ribbon. And the answer he got was this party line, oh, well, we're going to have something that incorporates the best elements of the Ribbon together with the Mac UI. And they always refer back to the Apple Human Interface Guidelines document, saying that, you know, it's a strong document and the Mac UI has to be very strong, therefore they can't deviate from the Human Interface Guidelines, which means you can't have a full Ribbon. Now, I've looked into this a little bit, and frankly, it's, well, to use an American expression, baloney. As all things Apple, the Human Interface Guidelines document is available online from the developer website. So this morning I had a quick browse through it, specifically looking at the areas where it defines the guidelines for menus. Because remember, what the Ribbon is about is taking the menu bar away and exposing the functionality you would normally access through the menu bar via the Ribbon instead. Now, what Apple's document says, bearing in mind it's only a guideline anyway, so it's not a hard and fast rule, well, what the guideline says is that you should have the Apple menu, an application menu, which is right next to the Apple menu, and most Apple applications obviously have this. It's normally the name of the application in bold letters. It's typically where people put the preferences for their application and the quick command to get you away from the application. And they also say you should have a window menu that allows you to control the windows into the application and a help menu. Then they say, optionally, you can have extra menu items for things like File, Edit, Insert, whatever you particularly need for your application. So to wrap up, what do they say you actually have to have in the guidelines? You've got to have the application menu and a window menu and a help menu, and the Apple menu that's provided by the operating system. So by my reading, according to the Human Interface Guidelines document, you don't need to offer all the functionality of your application through the menu bar. And of course, if you think about it, many of Apple's own applications don't offer all their functionality through the menu bar. Or if they do, they allow you to hide it and basically not use it. Take Apple's Aperture, for example. That's one of their most recent professional applications. And I use that all the time. And I hardly ever go to the menus because I don't need to. Because everything you need to do within the application is presented through the main window interface. So I can't help getting the feeling that Microsoft's statement that they have to comply with human interface guidelines is in fact an excuse for something else. I have discussed previously my perception that the Mac business unit at Microsoft is under-resourced, and I can't help feeling that the ribbon issue is yet another example of that under-resource. They don't have enough people to take the Office 2007 ribbon, which was only finalized when Office 2007 was shipped, and they don't have enough people to take that and transfer it into the Macintosh application. Given the amount of work they have to do in transferring the entire application to universal binary, I suspect what they'll do is they'll take the existing Office 2004 codebase and migrate it to universal binary, retaining the traditional menu structure. And then they will look at the usability of the application and make some changes to try and bring about some improvements. But those changes won't be anywhere near as comprehensive as the Ribbon UI. Now, this is only my perception. I could be completely wrong. They may either come up with something that retains the menus but completely wows us and offers us a completely new way of interacting with Office, or alternatively, the changes they make might bring enough functionality improvements to mean that we don't really feel we need the ribbon anyway. So, as I said, the product isn't out yet, so I don't want to prejudge it. However, I do feel that the Ribbon UI in Office 2007 is a smashing success, and I do believe it's unfortunate that it can't be transferred directly into the Macintosh version of the Office product. I will be seeking an opportunity to get Microsoft to comment on some of these issues, because I feel they haven't really been debated enough in the round. When they were all announced at the end of last year, there was quite a lot of blogging on them and in the forums, quite a lot of comment, but it's all died down since then. And I really strongly believe that in order for Microsoft to really understand the position they're in, it's important to keep these things discussed and also to keep us updated as to how these things are progressing within Microsoft. So I will be looking for some sort of response from Microsoft over the next few weeks. And if I do get anything, in whatever form it comes, I'll be the first to let you know.
That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Here at Book Bites Live on the MyMac.com podcast, we are overjoyed to have Deke McClellan at the other end of the line. Hi, Deke.
Hi, how are you, John?
Terrific. We are so glad to have you because we are extremely excited about the new release of Adobe Photoshop and Adobe Creative Suite CS3. We've heard a rumor that's going to be coming out this spring or this summer. We don't know any more information, but we know that Deke has prepared a totally public, totally free set of video tutorials sponsored by Lynda.com. Tell us briefly about your arrangement with Lynda.com and about these free tutorials that anybody can see from their homepage.
Well, first of all, you know, right, that the one element of CS3 that's out there and everybody knows about is Photoshop. So Photoshop's in public beta. You can download it from labs.adobe.com, and it's essentially free right now to anybody who has a Photoshop CS2 serial number, and any serial number will do. You can have an international serial number. It's only the English version of Photoshop that's available right now, but based on that, once we got wind that Adobe was going to go public beta on Photoshop, something they've never done before, I happened to be, I believe I was at the Lynda.com studios here in Ojai, California, found out about it. And we just started, you know, thinking, well, golly, you know, it's going to be several months where Photoshop is out there and there's no training on it whatsoever. And we really, like, we had to, you know, sort of pony up to the plate there. And we just dropped everything we were doing is essentially what happened. We just decided, all right, we're going to clear out the studio and I'm going to go in and I'm going to spend the next couple of days just banging out videos on Photoshop CS3 on the new features.
Excuse me for interrupting, mm-hmm. but how did you learn all the new features yourself in order to prepare yourself for doing this free video?
Well, and that's always a tricky thing. I mean, anytime we're this early in on the process, when the program is just sort of in beta and there's no documentation whatsoever out, it's a little bit dicey. So For example, like I've been part of the internal beta, the alpha and beta programs at Adobe for several months now. Photoshop CS3 had been, you know, available to certain people, you know, maybe about 100 people for a few months before it went into public beta in December. And so I've been using the program for a while, but it's going through a lot of changes during that period of time. So it's very difficult to sort of get a beat on what's going on. And meanwhile, their help files don't work and their documentation, you know, what documentation they have is totally incomplete. And so what you do, there's two things basically a person in my position is doing. You're reading the beta boards, and you're emailing the product managers and you're asking them questions. And sometimes you get responses and other times you get ignored and you're asking for features and so on and so on. The usual stuff where you're just sort of scurrying around. And then meanwhile, John Knack, there's this guy at Adobe who's the product manager for Photoshop, and his name's John Knack. And everybody that knows him will tell you he's one of the greatest guys on earth. He's really, really wonderful character. And he sat down and did us all a favor by doing some of his own videos, as it turns out. So there's these videos that are available just to the beta group that John created.
Wow.
And the funny thing about the John videos is they are lickety-split videos. I mean, there may be, like, there's only about six of them, and they're all about 2 minutes long. So there's not much to them.
Uh-huh.
But he talks just like, just like lightning. He's just like going, you know, zippity-zip through the software. But it's the kind of stuff where, like, I've been sitting there using this program now for, like, months, and I just had a few questions here and there, and just watching John just sort of, like, tear through a few features was like, oh, you know, that's how that works. And then I just, you know, so I'm piecing together all this stuff, and I would just find random things on a beta board where somebody discovered a feature, and, you know, I'm discovering my own stuff. So basically, it's you know, it's based on that, that I came up with these videos. And I have to tell you something, John. Since I put those videos out there, and like you said, they're free at lynda.com right now. You can just go up and watch them. But we released them, you know, a few months ago as we're talking, 2 months ago as we're talking. And since then, I've actually learned, you know, I've learned some more about how the programs work. So sure. You know, we've made additional changes to the video series that's going up live actually as we speak. So,
well, how much preparation do you, Deke, have to do? And by the way, we are talking to Deke McClelland of lynda.com, and he also writes for Deke Press and O'Reilly Media. How much preparation does Deke have to do for any of the lessons, such as, you know, how do you actually get going to make those terrific lessons?
Well, a lot is what it comes down to. It's actually a pretty painful process, because we all do, all the people who work here all spend a lot of time, sort of going through, you know, what it is that we want to teach, trying to find sample files, trying to find a cogent way to present the material. And, you know, and then we sit down and have a plan, and I'll create like really extensive outlines, John, just obscenely extensive actually. And, I've got this full Photoshop CS3 series that as I'm saying is coming out, and it's about 27 hours. So it's going to be really long. It's about a 70-page outline. It just goes on and on and on. Mm. But even so, even being that sort of meticulous in my planning, which sometimes I'm doing in advance, sometimes I'm doing on the fly, but even being that meticulous, I'll sit down and I'll start to record something and I'll go, nah, you know, that doesn't work, and I'll re-record it. I'll typically re-record one of these videos, you know, some irritating number of times. I wish it was like two or three times, but sometimes it's 10 or 12. And then until I feel like it's what it needs to be so the editors can deal with it. And then it goes through an editing cycle, and they clean it up and make me sound, you know, better than I normally would. And then it comes out the other end. A lot of time goes into it anyway. That's basically what it comes down to.
Well, it shows. But which applications do you use to record the live video and audio and then convert them into your QuickTime segments?
Well, here we just use screen recording software at Lynda. We use Camtasia on the PC, and we use Snaps Pro on the Mac. And that's for our desktops. And then I'll do live action stuff as well. And live action stuff, obviously, we're using, you know, a high-def camcorder. But the... But the interesting thing is there, the free stuff that I did, which is about an hour and a half worth of, I think it's all together something like 16 desktop movies about what, you know, the new features inside CS3. And
yeah, they're great.
And those, well, thank you. And those videos, I recorded on the Mac, and I recorded those in Snaps Pro. And the whole reason that we decided to go with the Mac, for that training was because, one of the great things about Photoshop CS3, and one of the reasons that Adobe decided to go with this public beta in the first place, was because Photoshop CS3 is universal binary. So it screams on one of the new Intel-based Macs. And whereas, of course, Photoshop CS2 is not, and it runs quite slowly. And so we figured, you know, the biggest advantage to the beta version of Photoshop CS3 was going to the big, you know, most remarkable advantage was going to be to the Intel Macintosh folks. So we might as well record there. Obviously, it's a big boon to PC people just in terms of the features. But 99% of my training, John, I have to tell you, I do on the PC. And the reason is, I'm really comfortable on both platforms. So it doesn't really matter that much to me. But B, Camtasia is just a much, much better program than Snaps Pro is. Snaps Pro takes much longer to render the movie after you get done recording it, and there's kinds of hitches and delays, and sometimes there's cursor issues, and Camtasia is just a better application is what it comes down to. So I'm able to crank out the movies a little more quickly on a PC than I am on the Mac.
Thanks for that explanation. Which new Photoshop CS3 feature took you, Deke McClellan, by surprise because you use it more than you anticipated?
Well, the one that took me by surprise, I'm not sure I have enough perspective at this point. I mean, even 6 months into, you know, 6-9 months into using CS3 now, I'm not sure that I have enough perspective to tell you which feature I use the most. But, well, that's not true. Actually, I have some thoughts there. But the feature that surprised me the most is brightness contrast. And I just, yes. I'm totally grooving on this thing because basically what's been going on is for the last 16 years since Photoshop first came out, there's been this command since the dark old days. There's been this command called brightness contrast. And, you know, one of the biggest problems that you can run into with an image is that, you know, it's washed out and there's not enough contrast or it's too dark or something along those lines. So you have brightness contrast issues and you want to, you know, adjust them. And so the simplest thing to do is go into this brightness contrast command. And the thing is, it is it's traditionally been an image destroyer. It actually harms images because it has a tendency to clip highlights and shadows, meaning it cuts them off and you end up with these harsh white areas inside of an image or harsh black areas. And it's a fairly terrible tool. Well, and basically everybody who gets on stage and talks about Photoshop or everybody does a video or a book, they always warn everybody away from using brightness contrast. And there's always a good, you know, quarter of the audience anymore that's still going, oh, really? I didn't know that. I've been using it, you know, that kind of thing. Well, all of a sudden, brightness contrast is great. I mean, they basically completely fixed the command and inside Photoshop CS3. And the reasons are a little technical, but it's still just one brightness slider and one contrast slider. It's just that they work differently than they used to in the past, and they no longer clip highlights and shadows. And now they never clip highlights and shadows. So they've gone from always clipping highlights and shadows to never clipping highlights and shadows. So it's a pretty big transformation. And I have to say, I do use it now. I do every once in a while take advantage of it. But if I had to say the thing, I guess the thing that has turned out to be the item that I use the most inside, or that I'm the most grateful for inside Photoshop CS3, and I, you know, who saw it coming the way it's been manifested is the new interface, and that's not really something you use, I suppose, is the new interface, but I can't tell you, going back to Photoshop CS2, how much I miss the way things work inside Photoshop CS3. And my guess is once people really start using CS3 between now and when it ships and after that and so on, there's going to be a lot of people that come to the software and just hate the new interface because a lot of it's kind of weird in terms of the way it works. But once you accept basically one or two limitations, then it's so much better. It is just absolutely so much better. You have so much more control over your screen space. You don't have problems with, you know, palettes being all over each other and all over the image and the image not respecting the palettes and all that jazz. It's just, it's a very tidy, well-organized, well-structured interface, and it gives you a lot more control. And for me, it just completely streamlines the experience, and I'm able to get work done faster.
And you cover both of those quite extensively in your free video, and that's L-Y-N-D-A, lynda.com. You'll see it right at the top of the page when you go to lynda.com. Unfortunately, we're running out of time a little bit, so we're going to bring you back when your books and your videos come out. When can we expect to see Deek's one-on-one series for Photoshop CS3 on the lynda.com site, and when can we expect to see it on DVD, and when can we expect to see it on a book from Deek Press?
Well, okay, as you say, the one-on-one is this brand basically that I'm doing in video, and I'm doing it in book form. So the video is going to be about 27 hours long. The entire thing is divided into 3 9-hour parts, and then the book is Photoshop, you know, CS3 one-on-one. It's and that book's been out there for a while now. The book for Photoshop and Photoshop CS2. The video just started coming out. So it's coming out in 4 pieces, and the first 7 chapters, it's going to be 27 chapters in all. The first 7 chapters came out last week. And so that's available now. That's you have to be a lynda.com subscriber to get hold of that, whereas the thing you were talking about
before is
free. And then and every 2 weeks they will come out with the next quarter. So by the end of March, you know, knock on wood, we should have the entire 27 hours up and available to people. And
even though the application hasn't been
even
released.
Though the application won't ship for a while after that. And so
amazing.
Yeah, so we're, you know, I'm pretty excited about that one actually. And the whole video is already done. We've already recorded everything, so it's just an edit.
And can people buy the video so they can take it home?
Well, and,
or does it only live on the internet?
DVD will come out sometime in April. And you'll be able to buy it. It'll be the same thing that's available online. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the book will hopefully come out late April, early May. That's our projection right now.
So it's all happening in the next few months. Actually, it's happening now over the next couple of months.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And let's remind our listeners, we are conversing with Deek McClelland of Deek Press and lynda.com. And we're talking about the new release of his one-on-one series here at Book Bites Live in the MyMac.com podcast. Now, you know, Deek, we could talk about this pretty much forever, but I'm going to say for right now, thank you. This has been spectacular, and we urge our listeners and readers to explore lynda.com, Deek Press, and to keep in touch with MyMac.com, because we're going to be following Deek as all these items are released. Any parting words to our listeners and readers as far as what we should be looking for from Deek Press, lynda.com, or Adobe Photoshop CS3?
Well, I don't know how many of your listeners get to Photoshop World. NAP, the National Association of Photoshop Professionals, the folks who publish Photoshop User Magazine, they have this twice annual event called Photoshop World. That's the biggest Photoshop conference there is. It's like 2,000 to 3,000 people. It's very exciting. They've got like 30 to 40 speakers, and in all walks of life. You know, you've got graphic artists and designers and photographers and so on. And there's going to be Photoshop World in Boston in April. And I'll be one of the first session that I'll be doing is going to be a ramp up of, you know, the new features inside Photoshop CS3.
Great. Okay. Well, I won't be there to visit you because I'll be at home playing with my beta release of Photoshop CS3 and playing around with those wonderful videos. Thank you so much, and we're delighted to have you, and we'll see you again as soon as we can here at Book Bites Live on the MyMac.com podcast. Thank you, Deek.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to mymacpodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the mymac.com podcast.